puck goes back of the net, and that is it. We had them all the way as the Leafs bury, well, beat the St. Louis Blues by a score of 6-5.
Tough one and fun. I think just back and forth. Up and down, bit of a roller coaster, but we found a way to win, and we're going home with 2 points, which is all that matters.
Tough and fun, up and down, roller coaster. That's Austin Matthews talking about the Leafs win over St. Louis. But honestly, he could be just describing the entire West Coast road trip. Up and down, good and bad. Feeling bad, feeling good. What happened here? What did we see? But at the end of it, we got 2 points, and that's what happened. The Toronto Maple Leafs face three of the league's best teams, all out in the Western Conference, all in front of fans. Vegas Golden Knights, Colorado Avalanche, and then the St. Louis Blues, who Ehlers pointed out on Friday are one of the best teams in the NHL recently at home. And they end up with 5 of 6 points. 5 of 6! And so you strip it all down, you just show people that, and you're supposed to say, well, wasn't that amazing? I'm going to just say this. This was one of the weirdest weekends I can remember in a little while with the Toronto Maple Leafs, or weirdest trips, I should say, not weirdest weekends, because that was just one game. But it was just the same thing over and over, where they win or they get points, but they blow leads, and it doesn't really feel great. Why doesn't it feel better? How are you guys feeling about this weekend? Let's get into the good and the bad, but let's just start with your general feel out of this West Coast road trip, which, by the way, I'm just going to strike from the record the Arizona game, because honestly, that was their best game in the entire trip, and then they sort of got snake-bit and lost. It's a bad loss, but just we're trying to evaluate them against the good teams. They're not going to play the Arizona Coyotes in the playoffs, right?
Certainly hope not.
Oh, I hope so. That would be so great. Could you imagine? First round. What do you mean you hope not? First round,
well,
Leafs get the Coyotes.
This is
the league rigs it so that we can finally get a win in this city. But yeah, just, Ehlers, I'll start with you. Just how are you feeling about the Leafs after this West Coast road trip?
You know that I'm always the optimist on the show. And I think there were definitely some positives to pull from it if you're looking for that. I thought Marner's return was exactly what I had hoped for. And we talked about it Friday. Like, this is a great narrative for him to come in and to solidify, hey, you know, I'm a really important part of this team. He was aggressive in all three zones. You know, you could really tell that they had missed his defensive impact over the last couple games away. He was creative. He was making plays. You know, he set up, I think, one or two goals. Got to see him on the PK again. You just realize, like, wow, Mitch Marner is so vital to this team. And I know he gets a lot of flack from Toronto media and Toronto fans and what he's done in the playoffs. But I think that return to the lineup really gave me a good feeling that when they have him and they have him healthy, you saw the trickle effect through the core four, I think. Matthews looked like, you know, he had a little bit of a rough start there on that O'Reilly turnover, but he gets back into it. Tavares had one of his best games in a while, I think, and he looked more engaged. And I just feel like when Mitch Marner's back in the lineup, it looked like things were clicking better. So I think that that's definitely a positive that I saw from the game. And so I was happy about that. I was excited to see him back in and to be dominant in your first game back after being sidelined with COVID. I think good things are there. Good things are there.
Sure, yeah. I liked Marner's return as well. I thought that it was the highlight from this particular weekend.
Right.
He ripped a shot, and everyone said, oh, where did that come from? Where did Mitch Marner get that shot from?
Oh, he worked
from
on his shooting.
He has a nice play behind the net on the power play where I thought, hey, this is probably more of the case to keep moving him around and maybe have him set up from behind the net once in a while, even though it was a little bit fortuitous. Like, he actually bobbles the puck, then recovers it, and it results in a way that he can find Austin Matthews. He also gets to pass it to Austin Matthews. But no, he was really, really solid in his return. But I would say that if we're going to lead in, I'm trying to tie all these games together, right? I'm trying to tie all of it together because one game samples don't really tell you much. I'm not going to draw a season end conclusion from three, but out of all of them, I do believe that the Stars being the Stars was a big component of this. That if you look at night in, night out, their best players, their core players, were awesome. Morgan Riley was really good in that game against the Blues. He played a ton of minutes, and he played very, very quality minutes against St. Louis. Mitch Marner came back. He was awesome. Tavares was amazing over the weekend. Mm-hmm. I thought that he played a very, very strong game Saturday night. Matthews has 10 goals in 10 games. He's absolutely just ripping twine right now. So, yes, the Stars being the Stars, I would say, is very much a positive, and that is something that we can take out of this. But just in terms of the general feel of this, like, Blake, let me kick this over to you, because that's the thing I can't shake, is the Stars are showing the way, and the Stars are playing as well as we could ask them to, and that is ultimately the main, puzzle piece for this team, right? When they've lost in the past, it's because the Stars haven't been going the way that we've needed them to. I just can't shake this. I should feel better about that. I should feel better about the Stars going, because ultimately that should matter more than anything else. And maybe that's where I'll get to after this talk, but there's something undercutting that, and I know some of those things. I'll get into them. But yeah, Blake, maybe it's just me. How are you just feeling about the state of the team after that trip? Let's just segment it into that trip.
Oh, I think Blake's muted.
Oh, wow, Blake.
That never happens to me.
Uh-oh, Blake.
Yes, not just me. Big win for old
Blake,
Club JD.
So, hey, quiet down over there, Nickel. 0 degrees Fahrenheit. I make mistakes all the time. So I think more so than just the Stars, I'm pretty comfortable with where the offense is at. Like, they got goal lead against Arizona, sure. But I think over this trip in general, you know, they scored 4, 4, 1, and 6. And... well, I guess the one was a 3 with the shootout and everything. And you can go back even further. And over the last 8 games, they've only scored fewer than 3 goals once. 35 goals over that span. The offense is clicking. And whether that's the Stars, you know, there have been some depth contributor games in there, especially, you know, when they came back after the break and everything. I just think the offense is clicking. And I think, JD, maybe why it doesn't feel... you're not feeling the optimism of, hey, the shooting percentage is finally regressing and like all these 5-on-5 chances are finally coming through, is that it's coincided with the defensive side, or at least the goaltending side, going in the other direction, where now instead of winning 3-1, 3-2 games, they're winning a bunch of 4-3, 5-4 games. And I wonder if maybe that's where it comes from for you, in that, hey, they did get 5 points on this trip. Did they get 5 points on this trip? Yeah, they got five points on this trip. But it, like, none of those games was like a resounding, hey, this is a dominant team. And I think, I wonder if maybe we got used to them dominating, or we got used to the defensive side being so strong, with Jack Campbell playing at the level he had been playing, that maybe that's what's going on there for you.
Okay, so... let me just start by saying, I don't know why I'm qualifying this as though I care what anybody thinks, but yeah, the Leafs were 2 games without Mitch Marner, too, getting those points, right? 2 of those games were, and I keep, again, I'm not referencing the Arizona game. So 2 of these games, they didn't have Mitch Marner, and we saw the impact that he can have in the St. Louis game. Overall, the team will go as far as these star players take them. That is my real core true belief. If their stars can outplay the other team's stars on any given night, then the Leafs will probably win, because I don't think that their goalie is a sieve, and I'm not really worried about Jack Campbell. I think that that dude has shown a track record now that he is a 1A goaltender in the NHL as of this very moment. Even if you look at the fact that Ryan O'Reilly scored 2 goals and Matthews didn't get the one, whatever. When Matthews' line was on the ice, they outshot O'Reilly's group, who's supposed to be the shutdown. They've won a Stanley Cup. They've done it the right way, blah, blah, blah. 14-6, even strength. 14-6, they outshot them. That's a beatdown. So, yes, there is a huge, huge, huge positive in the way that the star players are going right now. What concerns me is that I don't think this is how Sheldon Keefe wants to win. And it makes me think about Sheldon Keefe in the coach's office during the Amazon series saying, hey, we got to make sure that we're doing things the right way. And then Joe Thornton comes in there and goes, coach, we took 5 or 6 points from the best teams in the NHL. How about we go have a little party and buy some roller skates and take our tarps off? That's what concerns me just a little bit out of this, is playoff hockey is still a thing. And we can pretend like it isn't over and over and over again, but it is. My God, it is. And they don't look like a team in that those wins that would sustainably win playoff games. What do you need? You need goaltending and defense. Mm-hmm. And I like Morgan Rielly and Brody. TJ Brody has played terrific. So has Morgan Rielly. But after those two, it is just a shaky world of shake. I can't stand watching any of the other four defensemen play. Liljegren, I had the Liljegren weird fanboys in my mentions in my, you know, my Twitter over the weekend, because he's one of those players where people made up their mind he's good even though, like, they didn't even watch him. And for whatever reason, it's identity politics Twitter where people say, oh, this guy's this, blah, 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 blah. He's way, 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 way too soft for them to bring into the playoffs right now. You just look at two of those goals that St. Louis scored, and they are just direct results of that guy not being able to be hard enough to play against. Is he an NHL player? Has he taken a big step this year? Absolutely he is. But I don't think he's what Toronto needs in the playoffs. The problem is that why are you pointing out this guy when Justin Hall is playing the way that he is, and when Jake Muzzin's on the ice for every single one of these goals, and you're going, isn't Muzzin supposed to be a guy that I don't think is on a veteran minimum contract? He already looks like the defenseman that you pick up who won a Stanley Cup and is on the $1.2 million deal. And you go, well, you know, you're just trying to get by. He can't sustain this amount of ice time. It's becoming more and more and more clear that he is just not built for this anymore. And I don't know how this is going to get better as the season goes on, right? Like, this isn't a player who's in a shooting slump where you say, well, regression, and they're still playing good, and the number's 5-on-5. There's really nothing to support any belief outside of your fandom that this guy is going to turn it around. And every guy they throw him with, whether it's Liljegren or Hall or whatever, it doesn't seem to work. And so I like Sandin, but it's hard to be asking that kid to be your third defenseman at this point in his career. He's not exactly Mr. Lockdown. And so right now, what I think concerns me probably more than anything is it feels a little bit like the Leafs of early days, where you can run up the score against somebody, but you might not be able to protect the lead, and that makes me feel a little bit sweaty heading into big games.
Yeah, and the Muzzin thing seems particularly difficult to address, because what are your options, right? And you look, mm-hmm. and obviously Morgan Riley is carrying
the whole blue line.
Big load there. And TJ Brody could play more minutes. Like, TJ Brody should be ahead of Muzzin on the minutes chart right now. But you look at the second and third pair, and what are your options? It's like, okay, well, you can minimize Muzzin, which is fine. He probably shouldn't be playing 21, 22 minutes right now with just where he's at. Like, you can get that down a little bit. You can give Sandin a little bit more in that spot, and just, you know, like, Muzzin's at 22, Sandin's at 16. Maybe you get that to 19-19 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change the fact that you have two holes, not holes, but two spots on the right side that you're not super comfortable with. And because Muzzin no longer has that effect of bringing a partner up with him, mm-hmm. it's really uncomfortable to try to figure out what you do there, right? Like, it almost seems like the thing that you could try, and it's risky, and it is move Sandin to the right side and pair him with Muzzin and see if you can just solidify a second pair. But then you're just opening an even bigger hole on the third pair there. So, you know, part of this is just you're stronger on the left side than the right side, and that's just the nature of how you're going to be built. But, I mean, we've talked about this since day one of the season, basically. They've... Mm-hmm. It's got to be, as much as you want to minimize Muzzin, like, it's not... That's not a solution that's very obvious. Like, you're not going to have Sandin jump him entirely. I think the solution is going to have to be you try to address the right side in a way that can either, you know, provide a floor for Sandin playing up the lineup and playing more, or help stabilize a Muzzin pairing and maybe not drag Muzzin along, but just be a little more solid next to him.
You know what, though? This gets
it's not back a good
to,
spot.
Well, here's the thing. We have Bourne at 9 o'clock today, of course. That reminds me of 2019, where we talked about how you might have some pretty good blue liners independent of a situation or blah, 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 blah. Because again, I think that Liljegren is an NHL defenseman. I think Travis Dermott can be an NHL defenseman. This is not a... People confuse these conversations sometimes, right? Where they go, well, name a place that has better 6 and 7. Well, first of all, you don't know those places because the only team that you ever watch is the Leafs. So you think all these guys are superstars because they're name brands to you. But secondarily, yeah, I do think that they're good 6 or 7th defensemen, but not on this team. It's where you go and you say, everyone can be solid, but the puzzle pieces don't work, right? Like, if you're going to move Sandin up, I actually would guess that the Leafs would try Muzzin on the right side, and they would say to Sandin that he gets to play in his spot. But that's not a good puzzle piece. That's not making me feel good about the postseason. Mm-hmm. That's not making me feel anything better. And then you still have to get those minutes, those 12 minutes a night from your third pairing where you're feeling scared. I like Liljegren. I really do. I can't believe how much I like him. But I don't want him on the ice come playoff time. I don't want Travis Dermott on the ice come playoff time. I've been down this road before where I see the physical tools, I see all the stuff, and I think, why can't you put this together? He hasn't been able to. Maybe he does it somewhere else. Maybe he does it better somewhere else. But on this Leafs team, I don't want to see Travis Dermott in a big spot. And Justin Hall, it's a similar thing. Now you throw Muzzin into that, Blake. I think that's the main point in all of this. Muzzin, going back to trucks and trailers that we taught, that analogy that I stole from Daniel Jeremiah, he used to be a truck where it didn't matter. Nikita Zaitsev looked good next to him. I thought the Leafs should keep Nikita Zaitsev after he was with Jake Muzzin. I was like, is the contract that bad if he's next to Jake? Everyone has looked good next to him except for now, where they can't find someone that he works with. And so with those four, you start to say things like, all right, even if they go into the deadline and try to address this, even if they go into the deadline and try to flip somebody, it's only one name potentially out of here, and it's not enough salary to really move things around. And people are right. The take is correct. When people go, well, who's going to be better at that salary? I say, I don't think anyone. I don't think that that's a possibility. I don't know what happens here without a drastic change where your blue line is better. And so it can feel like picking at nits when the Leafs do this, and yes, but now it feels more and more like, hey, it's even more on the Stars than we thought it was, because this season was about depth, and they might have it more on the forward side of things, but on the blue line, it's thin. It's really not. I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
Yeah, and I mean, the trickle effect on that is so much more on Jack Campbell, and I think we've seen that over the last couple of weeks where he's starting to let in more goals, and he's, you know, I think he's really fatigued, and I think the narrative here is like he's bailed out the defense over and over again, and I think Saturday really exposed that their coverage down low, when that's weak, they're very vulnerable, and I think that so many games that they've been able to rely on Jack Campbell has helped us be like, oh, Jack Campbell is the MVP. He's the player on this team that is most important. Well, when he's a little bit exhausted and a little bit worn out, that's when the D looks even more exposed. And I think this weekend was like kind of the tipping point to be like, whoa, okay, we really need to address this, because if poor Jack Campbell can't do this all himself.
Some of it will. You're not going to face those teams every night. You're going to end up facing some lesser light opponents. And so I would imagine there would be a slightly lower workload on Jack moving forward here in the vast majority of these games. I also did actually think that Jack Campbell was a sneaky positive out of this trip, despite everything that happened. It was I can't remember who said it on the panel after the game, but it was true. It might have been Elliot, where Binnington lets in a backbreaker of a goal. My God, that was awful.
Boy.
The Mikheyev one.
He's a whole thing, Binnington.
That was... That's one of those things too where I wonder, he has a Stanley Cup, so guys in that locker or in that dressing room, apparently he's pretty popular too, but he's a bit of a wild card, and he likes to talk, and he's got the antics, and
he likes to slash people.
I know, and you let in a goal like that when you are like that. I guess what? Guys went out for drinks that night and they talked about old Binner. they had a couple of thoughts about him in that performance. But Jack Campbell came up with stops late, right? He actually, there were some real opportunities that St. Louis had in that game, and he didn't look tired down the stretch. And when I'm watching him right now, it doesn't feel the same way to me, Ailish, and maybe this is just a feel thing, as before that COVID break in this season, where I actually did see a version of Jack Campbell that didn't look as quick, that didn't look as sharp, that did look like he was dragging for moments. This just seems like high quality of competition getting a million chances against him, and that no goalie on planet Earth is going to stop that many good chances from this kind of quality of opponent.
No, I completely agree. And I guess my point to that is that I still think he's the most valuable player on this team and the most consistent. Like he held them in that game. But my concern is that the more and more that he has to be the one when the defense core is struggling and they're making errors and they're not being hard on the puck in the corners, is like he's not invincible. And he has also not played a full season. Like he's a new starting player and we haven't seen him tested for an entire amount of time. And I think that is the one little nervous moment that I have, is like, we saw Mrazek. God forbid that something happens to Jack Campbell and we're stuck with the Mrazek-Hutchinson duo. So I just think, like, if you want to have longevity with Jack Campbell, you got to strengthen your decor, or else he's just going to be, 2 months of this isn't sustainable.
I just don't know how they're going to
strengthen
that core.
What you do. I know. It's a tough question.
And I do think Matthews, if we're doing weird, the weird side take of team MVP race, Matthews has taken the lead.
It's now
Matthews 1A, Jack Campbell 1B. Blake, I know that you've got something to help, something to set us up on, to chew on. God, that's an awkward way to try to transition this.
Boy.
You've got something on, something
He's serving
to chew
us
on.
Something to chew
I
on.
I have something for you to chew on.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one. Okay, you do that.
I have something for you to chew on, and it's brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. So as luck would have it, I have some numbers here on the Campbell swing or the defense swing. So mostly what I want to chew on here is there are two possible explanations for this. So over the Leafs' last 10 games, that goes back to December 7th, you split the season into the first part of the season and the last 10 games, and it has looked like the defense is letting up more chances and higher quality chances. The advanced metrics are almost identical. 0.5 difference in shot attempts per 60, 0.02 difference in expected goals allowed, 0.3 difference in high danger chances per 60. However, Jack Campbell's save percentage has dropped to 906 over that stretch. Now, a chunk of that stretch, we were talking about, hey, Jack Campbell's top 10, borderline top 5 in the NHL in minutes. Is he getting fatigued? So there are two possible explanations here. One is Jack Campbell has regressed a little bit, and the Leafs haven't gotten worse defensively. He was just hiding some of the shakiness on the defensive end for them by having this monster start the season. The other side of that would be that there's not a ton of cause for concern here because the Leafs have been the same team and these things are going to ebb and flow. So I think you guys are probably going to lean on the Jack Campbell was hiding some issues earlier in the season. But the something to chew on here is that the Leafs have looked much worse defensively, even though all the advanced metrics are the same. And Ailish, I think the real chew there is Jack Campbell is this team's MVP so far, and there's not a ton of question there. But a couple different ways you guys could go with that. So curious how you feel about hearing that.
Well, to me, it's 0.000 surprise. This is what if the blue line had just been shaky for a few games, I would have said it's no big deal. They won these games. Blah 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 blah. The issue here is that we've seen this now for the entire season. Blake, you're giving us something to chew on that we've been chewing on all year. We've talked about these numbers. I did a take it or leave it on why Jack Campbell is the Leafs MVP right now because he was papering over those stats. The Leafs have not been very good defensively this season as a team. As a team,
we have a 10-game sample of data now to be like, look, before and after. So the chew on here is that what we were talking about, and it was purely anecdotal for a while, now has a good chunk of data to compare and contrast. So
exactly. And do I think that the Leafs could end up in a playoff series where Jack Campbell is the better of the two goaltenders? Absolutely, I do. That guy's been amazing this year. That's part of being one of the best players on the team. The goalie is still a part of the team. The goalie still has something. But it does tell you that this team, despite where they are from a roster construction standpoint, which is very, very powerful, their stars going the way that they are right now, as good as that is, it can just be undercut immediately by the way that you'd play team defense, that you're leveling the playing field here. Again, when we get back to the way Sheldon Keefe wants to play, I'm not sure how many of these games this season, when he's going over the tape with his coaches, when he's looking at these numbers, he's saying to himself, it's okay, this is the way that we want to do it. We want to put an immense workload on Jack. We want to force Jack into having a 930 save percentage every night for us to win. That shouldn't be the case. It tells you that if he dips down to having a mediocre time, you're going to let in a bunch of goals. It's just that's the way that it's going to be. He has to be basically excellent for you to win a Stanley Cup, which shouldn't really be the case.
Totally
agree.
Anything
else on that, Ailish? Yeah.
No.
Nope,
you said it all.
Totally agree.
Yeah. Strengthens your Jack
retweet.
Campbell.
Retweet.
Yeah. So chew on that a little bit. It's something, you know, look, we're going to chomp away on this between now and the trade deadline because the right side on the second and third pair need some help. One day we'll chew on an actual solution that isn't Mark Pisick, but we'll get to that over the next couple months. A team that's much closer to the trade deadline, but maybe not all that closer to having a decision on which direction they're going, Toronto Raptors, because they had the most Raptors-y weekend imaginable. Oh, they get embarrassed by Dwayne Casey's Pistons, and then they overperform in upsetting the defending champion Milwaukee Bucks. We're going to talk about your Raptors after the break. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan. Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, Judy Bunkus. Hope you're okay out there, folks, commuting. We got a couple texts in that people are in snowbanks. So be safe. Be careful.
So you know me. I like to check the Instagram DMs between the breaks because that's usually where people leave me nice messages for the show.
Uh-oh.
I like to read them. I use them as content. It's another version of text line, right? At JD Bunkus. It is basic season right now. Blake Murphy participating in such. People who live in condos taking pictures. Do you guys see that it is snowing out here? Here's a picture of the snow. And if you go through Instagram stories right now, it's just, here's snow from someone's apartment. Here's snow from Blake's apartment.
I got to post one now just
I was going to say, go to your guys' Instagram so that if you want to see what snow looks like from their buildings, go to their Instagram. You can see them. I will not be posting snow from a condo today, but balcony views, high-rise views. It's part of living in a condo experience is anytime it snows for the first time or the big first snowstorm, the condo people are out in droves with their, look how crazy the weather is. We will be getting a lot of posts today. How crazy
it's
the weather is.
More about the lack of visibility than the snow.
Sure.
When I woke up, it was like yellow outside.
Yeah, it's creepy.
So, JD, the truth here is JD's just mad that I posted a photo of my coffee mug this morning, which is like this Picasso-y OG Ananobi mug.
I love that mug.
Yeah, but your face is blurry in the photo, so I'm assuming
that's why you're upset. No, I love that because I got morning face. So my face being blurry, people might look at it and go, is that guy handsome? And the answer is no.
JD's beautiful all times of day.
JD's catfishing on Blake's Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. But all my face should be blurry face. This is great. Yeah. Leave a little mystery out there. So, yes, a little mystery about the Raptors weekend too, right?
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, well, mystery in the sense that this team is this team, but no mystery. Like, we talked about it on Friday. I had text conversations with some friends on Friday afternoon too, and it's like, oh, is this a big back-to-back? No, it's the most predictable back-to-back on the Raptors schedule in that, of course, Dwayne Casey's Pistons are going to beat them. Casey is now 8-3 against the Raptors since leaving, which is ridiculous because the Pistons have won like three other games during those four seasons.
Which is why I bet Moneyline Pistons, and I was very happy about that.
You weren't alone. Honestly, a shocker. So I've tried to avoid picking the Raps or against the Raps in the Wake and Rake, but I was shocked that neither of you went Pistons for the old Wake and Rake on Friday.
Well, it's hard to say that. People are going to be mad at us.
Yeah, it didn't matter because the three of us hit ours, and it was Coolbet Chris who was the trapdoor. But
can I just say something between the three of us? Whenever we ask Coolbet Chris, all right, this is just between the audience and us now, all right? This is a secret time, all right?
I never bet his bets.
Yeah. Bing bong. Never bet Chris's best. Chris is terrible at picking games. This is our whole relationship. This is what I was saying about our... You know that we would have legitimately won, like, huge money in our Circa Million Dollar contest this year if it wasn't for Chris? It was insane. Our team, Pat Gregoire, myself, and Justin Bourne, we picked winners against the spread all season long. You might ask yourself, hey, JD, how did you end up picking 8 straight weeks against the spread correctly, but not even be close to the money in the Circa Million contest? Chris, the anchor. This guy is just like, he's from out east. He's an anchor. I think his family builds anchors for a living for ships. No. That's what they do. They're from a long lineage of anchors. Whenever we do this, secret time between the group. Again, just us. Just say, hey, just us in the audience.
Don't tell him.
Just as us. When we go, hey, Chris, what's your part of the Wake and Rake? Here we go. Don't bet it. We're all – just bet the three that the – what is it? The trident of winning.
Yeah.
The trident of winning that is our show.
So – here's the issue with that. Well, this week I did ours standalone and I did a side bet on Coolbet Chris's lacrosse thing, which, by the way, was not even close. I think it was 14-13 final.
Yeah.
I think he just wants to win money. So he's just like, yeah guys, do this.
So the only qualifier
on the other side
is that our biggest payout in terms of return of the Wake and Rake included a Chris W. That was on January 7th, that Friday. We went 4-0. Right. So that's the thing here is, like, you add a
Blake always ruining things with his numbers and facts. Just has to come in with his numbers and facts and spoil the party.
You add a fourth leg to a parlay and it gets so spicy. But also, like, the fourth leg here is the wobbly leg. It's the one we're jamming matchbooks under to try to get it with the wobbliest chair in all of Philadelphia.
Yeah, but that table, if it does work out, now you got a table at the bar. You got a seat at the bar. So, yeah, let's get back into the Raptors. You're right.
Yeah.
It was a great pick by everybody. Who cares? I will always fade the Raptors if I feel like it's time to fade the Raptors. I'm not afraid like the two of you.
Oh, I'll do it. I just don't want to do it in the Wake and Rake.
Yeah. But, yeah, this weekend, the loss to Dwayne Casey. This is such a – Blake, can I just set you up this way? The loss to Dwayne Casey was predictable, and yet I feel like this Raptors team just somehow – and I know there's no Jrue Holiday, and I've said before, I really believe that Jrue Holiday is so unbelievably important to that team because of what the drop-off is in guard play there and just how they go from the thing to the next. Like, Chris Middleton, to me, is not even in the conversation of second most important player on that team. It's all Jrue Holiday. But either way, that – it was almost just as predictable that the Raptors were going to find a way to win it that way, but maybe just not the way that they actually ended up doing it, which was how well Pascal Siakam played.
Yeah, I would argue that if you looked at every game of Pascal's career, we'll go regular season only because he had some monster playoff performances, and you look at things like how badly did the team need that performance? How good was he overall? What was the quality of competition like? You could make a very good argument that was the best game of Pascal Siakam's career, regular season-wise. 30-10-10, only took 20 field goal attempts to get to the 30 points. He did have 6 turnovers and 5 fouls. Like, all of the Raptors' good players danced around foul trouble in that game, which is hilarious because the Bucks had 35 free throw attempts and were openly complaining after the game that they should have had more. And a friend of mine who's a Bucks writer was like, do the Raptors always hack teams and get away with it this much? I'm like, they're a physical, aggressive defense, but 35 free throws. How many free throw attempts do you think you're going to get in a game? But yeah, so he had a little bit of foul trouble. And you know, you're going to make some turnovers against a defense as good as the Bucks. But I thought he was awesome. And you know, 30 points on 24 shooting possessions is very efficient. The 10 assists is a continuation of what we've been talking about a fair amount over the last couple of weeks, which is he's really coming into his own as the lead ball handler. And Fred didn't have the most efficient shooting night there, but you see how it works where Fred gets to play off the ball. And especially against a team with the length and defense that Milwaukee has, that is a preferable dynamic for the offense than Fred handling and trying to, and look, he did a good job passing around traps and finding short rollers and stuff like that. Fred did, but the team looked way better when the ball was in Pascal's hands. So all around, I thought it was a monster Siakam game. And just, yeah, I mean, he's been, JD, you set it up on Friday, like, hey, is this one of the best stretches of his career? And I pulled the data on that on Friday during the show. And like, you can make arguments for other chunks of time, but it's getting pretty flimsy. These last 10, 11 games are about as good as he's played in the regular season.
Yeah, and my takeaway from just that game is that he's looking so much more comfortable and confident. And I think that my like relation to why that is because he's taken less pressure off. He's taken pressure off himself and he's playing comfortable. He's playing with swagger. He looks loose. And I think that is because Fred's been playing so well and he can kind of take that pressure off himself of being the man. But at the same time, he looked like he wanted to have the ball late in his hand, late in the game. He didn't think about giving it up. He had that confidence of like, hey, I believe in myself. And I think that that's something that's been missing from his game. And that's something that we've seen over the stretch of him playing well is he looks like the Pascal Siakam that you want, which is that confidence and the looseness that he's playing with. And I think it's because Fred's been playing so well and he can kind of take a little bit of pressure off himself, but you know, that's difficult to analyze unless you're Blake, you might have a stat for it. But I definitely think that is my take on it. If I'm a fan watching,
you know, we spend so much time talking about that quote about I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Mm-hmm. And even I actually kind of feel like almost undercutting everything with Siakam with, but it's Fred. Like, yeah, Fred's playing well, but this version of Siakam, he deserves just the whole world of credit for. Like, I don't want to give anybody else, you know, the shine for what Siakam is doing right now. But to me, the quote that I'm thinking of with Siakam right now is not that I want to be the man. it was coming out of the bubble or coming off that Boston series where he said, I need to find the joy again, or I need to be happy again playing basketball. And that's what I see, is a guy who once again is enjoying what he does for a living. And that's coming through in spades, night in, night out. Is there's a joy that has returned to Siakam's game, and it is now coinciding with the best play of his career.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've tweeted before about this, that, like, Siakam gets this little smirk, right, when you can tell that that's going. And it's not quite a, like, I'm having fun smile. It's more of a, like, I'm feeling myself smile.
Exactly. And that's that swagger, like, I was saying.
Like,
he's got it.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, the Bucks are such a great example, because I don't know if they dislike each other off the court, but him and Bobby Portis have, like, a long-running thing where, at least between the lines, they do not like each other. So Siakam going off like that, and you even heard, so the last Bucks meeting, Siakam and Portis end the game yelling, yes, sir, at each other after missed free throws and stuff like that. And Siakam gets that late transition bucket, and the broadcast picks up Fred screaming, yes, sir, because Siakam's doing this against Portis again. And I think that that's just, like, that's a good snapshot of it. And I think, obviously, Fred and Pascal, the better one plays, the easier things get for the other. You look at them as a duo right now, like, JD, I know you're fond of turning positives into negatives, so let me give you this one. Siakam's going to steal some of Van Vliet's coaches' votes for the All-Star game.
Right now, I will say this. As good as Fred is playing, I think that Siakam is playing better. Really, I do. I Fred, to me, is still the consistent night in, night out. What is the? I got to remember the JV thing. General.
The court captain.
Court leader. court captain. Yes, court captain. There's no doubt about it. Fred is the court captain. Fred is still the embodiment, the attitude of this team, right? He is just the torchbearer from Lowry. He has been incredible. But Siakam is the team's best player when he's at his best. That's just very clear. And a lot of it has to do with just the fact that, hey, size in the NBA still matters. And one of these dudes is 6'10", and the other guy is closer to 5'10", right? There's a foot between the two of them. But I think that what is impressing me the most about Siakam is just, one, there's a consistency to this now, right? Where Siakam earlier this season and in years past where he's played well, we've seen this where we go, oh, look, this guy, he's a max player. Look what he just did tonight. Look at this 30-10 game that he just posted together with 6 assists. He was brilliant tonight. The stats, Blake, you're right. This is a, he's not a triple-double guy normally with 10 assists, 10 rebounds. That's not something that we've been accustomed to in his career. So this one's a little bit of an anomaly or a step up. Right, this is a step up, but we're used to seeing performances of this ilk from Siakam, but stringing them together has always been the issue for this player. And then there's one night where he fades away and you don't see enough of him on the floor, where he doesn't touch the ball enough, or he's not shooting very well from the field, and you end up having one of those, like, 5-13 nights from Siakam, and everybody on Twitter is roasting him. But right now, what we're seeing with Siakam is stringing games together, playing with a ton of confidence, and the big thing for me, just the proper, this is probably just a reps thing. He just seems to be making the right play way more often than not. When he's got a mismatch down low where there's somebody, he's got the ball on the block, there's some loser down there that's way too small or way too slow to stop Siakam, he's spinning off of him, he's scoring at the basket. He's not doing that annoying Siakam runs at the rim and then throws the ball up in the air like a crappy guy in a gym who's just praying for a shot and then screams for a foul and then the team is getting burned in transition the other way. He's not taking ill-advised threes off the dribble early in the shot clock. Like, he's making really good plays. If they're doubling him or one of his other teammates has a mismatch, he's finding them. He is just putting it all together right now. And a lot of it is just the playmaking. It's not about playmaking always for yourself. It's about playmaking for other people and identifying who needs the ball in the right times. And I've never seen him do it like this before. Really, I've never seen Siakam over a stretch of time figure out what the dynamics were on the offensive end of the ball the way that he has. Like, he's always felt like a guy who was too fast for the game. The game looks like it's slowing down for him right now.
Yeah, and you mentioned the consistency, and this is like, we're talking a long stretch of consistency now. So over his last, he's only played 27 games this year. So let's give him the first 5 games of the season as like a ramp up period or whatever. The 22 since, he's scored under 16 points once. And in that game, he had 12 rebounds too, and was a plus, and they won. So there are not these like stretches. They're not even individual games where he's not showing up on the score sheet. And then you want to talk about the playmaking consistency. Let's narrow it down to the last 10 since he came back from COVID. Almost 7 assists a game. 24.5 points, 10 rebounds, 6.6 assists over a 10-game stretch. And 10 games is only 10 games, but it's also more than a third of his season so far. Mm-hmm. And it's the chunk since he got back from COVID. And shocker, it's coincided with the Raptors.
Only you
really
would
well.
Say 10 games is 10 games, by the way. Every other fan listening that goes like, 10 games is a good sample. Only Blake in the in the baseball like nerddom is like, only 10 games. I'm like, 10 games? It's amazing.
Well,
that's
Babbitt,
so good. It's a
Babbitt
lot of games.
In these games.
Yeah, I know.
And he's like, he's hit like, again, like the sample size stuff, but he's hit 42% of his threes in that stretch. He's shooting almost 50% overall. If there's a gripe, it's that his free throw shooting hasn't been very good of late. But even then, he had like that 10 of 10 game to ice it against the Pelicans. Like, it's really hard to come up with anything you're not thrilled about with Siakam right now. And to kind of tie it back to what the conversation was 2 weeks ago where Fred was so hot, go back and watch some of the second half of that Milwaukee game. And this has always been the case a little bit because these guys have played together since summer league, the year that Siakam was drafted and Fred got signed. The Raptors in clutch situations the last little while have started spamming Fred Pascal actions where it's either a Fred handling and Pascal screening or vice versa. And it's really, really hard to guard. And then you've got this second layer of things where they're both so smart and have such great chemistry that there was a bucket the Raptors got late where Fred waved off Siakam to get Champagne screening instead because of the matchup Siakam had. And it ends with a Siakam basket. And it's basically because Fred and Pascal knew, like, no, we got to go away from this because I'm going to get you your bucket another way. And you're starting to see, like, 6 years is a really long time for two guys to play together. And now that they have a third of a season playing together as the 1A, 1B, you're starting to see that stuff click.
Okay, so we all agree Siakam is playing incredibly well. And we'll talk a lot more about the Raptors over the next couple of days. Again, they play tonight. They play the Miami Heat. We only have a few minutes. That's what I wanted to touch on is, okay, but can I do a spin zone for you? I'm actually kind of happy that there's no Kyle in this game. Not that he's hurt or whatever. This just felt very unceremonious. It's sort of buried in NFL wildcard weekend. There's this exciting still. There's another football game tonight that we have that I do want to pay attention to both games. But Lowry and the way that he interacts with the Raptors, that would have taken a lot of my attention. And I'm still going to watch both these games. Duh, this is what I do. But I'm kind of glad. It's a January night. I kind of want Lowry's return. And I know they play the Heat a bunch coming up here, right? They play the Heat a stupid amount of games. I was looking at the schedule this morning, and they play the Heat today. They play the Heat January 29th, January 29th, and then February 1st. They're just basically playing the Heat the rest of the year. But I kind of hope in a weird way that the first Lowry game is February 1st and there's some fans in the seats. Like, maybe I'm just trying to be the world's most optimistic person, but there's just this small part of me that goes, hey, could we have – Kyle Lowry back in Toronto with fans back in Toronto, could that potentially be a thing? I'm hoping for it.
I think there's a significant difference of how I feel wanting to push this game back than like Danny Green wanting to get his ring. And obviously we joke about that a lot. Like, I think that
a lot. It's now becoming abusive.
It's just so silly. But no, I see your point. I kind of agree with you. I mean, it would be sad to see this night happen without any fanfare. He's arguably the GOAT, greatest Raptor of all time. You know, there's going to be
arguably.
A statue. Yeah. So, well, I mean, some people argue it, not me, but I think you're right. It would be tough to have that happen and to not feel like he's celebrated enough. And he's out tonight for personal reasons. So not like a COVID situation, I don't think so. That, you know, that's a sign that maybe he can play in one of these games coming up. So I feel you, JD. I'm going to agree with you on this one.
Yeah. So there's also a bit of an expectation, and I don't know how much this is people assuming where Lowry's at or how the Heat will handle this, but his visit to Toronto is the Heat's fourth game in 5 nights. And knowing Lowry a little bit, and if there are still no fans in the arena, which it certainly seems like we're headed for, I could absolutely see him not playing in that game as well. And, you know, it'll get the DNP rest or whatever because it's the fourth game in 5 nights. But Kyle's smart. Kyle has a high emotional intelligence, a big attachment to this city. it would not surprise me if the first time we see, I mean, maybe like they play twice in a row, so he'll probably play that January 29th one in Miami, but that like Kyle's circling the April 3rd return in Toronto.
And wouldn't they still do like a video tribute even if he's not playing though?
No, but that would be no, so cool.
I think if he wasn't playing and there's no fans, I think that the Raptors would be like, hey, Kyle, like, we're not going to do this reason. Like, they're not going to risk upsetting. Like, you are eating Goran Dragic's money all year to basically, because you wanted to make Kyle happy on his way out, you're not going to drop the ball on his return as well. So I would say if you're a Raptor fan and a Lowry fan, just cross your fingers that we can be back in arenas by April 3rd. Even Fred said it on Saturday. They asked him if they were excited to play the game, and he was like, not really. I think the one we talked about was obviously his return to Toronto. So yeah, let's get fans back in the arena by April 3rd, please, because that has the potential to be one of the most emotional nights like ever as a Raptors fan. And like we've seen far lesser players come back and have really nice moments with the Toronto crowd. That one is going to be if you don't make Kyle Lowry cry, Toronto Raptors fans, you have failed. You made Vince Carter cry when he was on like his eighth return tour.
Everything made Vince Carter cry. Everything made Vince Carter cry.
But I'm saying you better make Kyle Lowry cry. So let's hope we're back in the arena by April 3rd.
Yeah. I actually would view it. I kind of want Kyle Lowry to beat the fans. I don't want him to cry. You know, like I want to see Kyle Lowry be so staunch in his, you know, resting dick face.
No, how Kyle is going to beat the fans is that April game is pretty late in the season. So how Kyle's going to beat the fans is he's going to stick it to them from a competitive standpoint. Like that's the Raptors' fifth last game of the season. He's going to knock them back into the play-in by taking like eight charges in the fourth quarter or something like that. That's how he gets his shot in.
We got to go, but was it just me or did this lead up feel as though it wasn't very big? Is that just because it was a COVID thing, the way that we feel about these games in terms of not looking too far ahead and not getting expectations? But, you know, the fact that Lowry ended up actually being canceled tonight, the Lowry game ends up not being tonight, I kind of went – a part of the reason why I felt that way was I wasn't excited for it because it wasn't really built up. And I don't
know – and it's a Miami thing, right? Like, I just think it's fun. Like, it's a fun moment on the calendar. 82 games is a lot of games, so to have a game that you can circle and be like, I'm excited to see Kyle against Fred, that's one thing, but there's not the emotional punch. Like the Miami crowd has no investment in Kyle's attachment to Toronto. They don't care. So it's all about Lowry's return to Toronto. That's a little while away.